Accused is nominated for a People's Choice Webby Award for Best Writing. If you're a fan of the work we've done, please consider casting a vote for Accused at bit.ly/accusedwebby or go to vote.webbyawards.com and vote in the Best Writing Podcast category. Voting is open until April 20th.
On December 31st, 1997, at a New Year's Eve party, Cheryl Shepherd was proposed to on live TV. 2 days later, she disappeared and was never seen again. Host David Richin heads to Hamilton, Ontario to investigate the case. Someone Knows Something, Season 2. Subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
I'm Amber Hunt, and this is Accused, the unsolved murder of Elizabeth Andes. On the last episode...
They have lost that sewing kit. They've lost the scissors. They've lost the clothing from Beth. They've lost everything except paperwork, written reports and so forth. They say they've lost it.
I give that no credence whatsoever until we've done everything we can do to check every single possible place it could be, including the court reporter who was in charge of the case. We found cases where the court reporter took it home and put it in her garage afterwards.
We're coming to the end of this series, at least the end of the planned episodes. If we're lucky and we reach the right people, maybe we'll have drummed up some of those new tips I was fantasizing about in episode one. And we'll have to come back, record some updates, maybe even report on a trial. Fingers crossed, right? For now, I'll try to tie up as many loose ends as possible. Because, in truth, that's been a lot of the reporting process here. We hear something that sounds important, and we chase it down. Some of these chases have been tidbits presented to us as solid fact by police officers. Things that really did sound damning for Bob Young. These are the types of tips that made my producer, Amanda, and I pause a few times. Were we investing all this time in a case that isn't unsolved at all? Here's one of the tidbits. Remember how Beth got a new wallet for Christmas that was never found after her death? Her old wallet was in her bedroom, but the new one, the one Bob Young's parents gave her as a gift with a matching cigarette case, had disappeared. Well, Assistant Chief John Buchholz told us.
Of course, you remember the missing purse. They thought it was a robbery and stuff like that. It turned out old Doc Boone, the coroner, had it in his safe. And just on and on and on.
The wallet, you mean?
Or the wallet, yeah, not the purse.
Really? That ended up being in the
Something they thought had been stolen, you know, which was part of the defense.
Okay.
You know, it turned out to be in his safe when he died. They found it.
This would be big. Steve Schwein, the police chief in the 90s, had also heard this. It's one of the reasons that when he looked in vain to reopen the case, he did it while trying to figure out another way to hold Bob Young accountable, like maybe by charging him federally with violating Beth's civil rights.
The story was that, the version I heard was that the coroner at the time had taken some of Beth's belongings and put them away. And at the trial, within the belongings were either a purse or a billfold. I don't recall what was said, but anyhow, at the trial, one of the issues was raised that could have been a robbery because her purse is missing or her billfold is missing. And then years later, when the coroner retired and they were cleaning out the lockers or file cabinets or whatever else, lo and behold, here's her purse or billfold or whatever it was. Is that true or is it not true? I don't know.
Amanda and I knew we'd have to check this out. And there was another rumor we wanted to investigate. I heard this one first in a phone call with former chief Joseph Statham. He brought it up again when we met in person.
Did you ever check to see if I heard, and I don't know, but I heard that he was picked up in Texas around the Houston area for some serious crime. And I don't know if he was convicted or not.
Yeah. The version of this that Schwein heard was more specific.
The rumor was that he was involved in an incident down there that resulted in the death of another woman.
This would also be huge because it would show that Bob Young was indeed capable of murder. But Schwein was quick to add.
Don't know if that ever happened or not. You know, well, I went online, about this time, you start over the years, computers, and I could never find anything, but that's what people up there believed.
I told Bob Young this rumor. You've heard how quiet he generally is. He was still soft-spoken when he responded, but there was a rare swear word in the mix.
Law enforcement will say, oh yeah, I heard in Houston he was accused of basically the exact same thing.
Bullshit. That's never happened. I've never been arrested for anything. I think I had one traffic incident. That's it. Who said that?
Someone. You want to be a couple different. So, and here's something too. There was a police chief in between. So somebody who wasn't involved in but he came in after and he was interested in reopening it. And he tried a few times and was told that the civil suit had been settled. And that as part of the settlement, everything was sealed and the evidence was off the table.
We didn't settle anything. We didn't have any money.
What else did he say? He also said...
That's just unbelievable.
Amanda and I set out to find this supposed arrest. I checked court records in Harris County, Texas, as well as several neighboring counties. I couldn't find a formal charge. Worried that maybe I would miss something searching for records in another state, I even called courthouses and asked workers there to check for me.
No, it's a little bit of a fishing expedition. It's basically somebody who was a suspect up here. He was acquitted, and somebody sort of said in passing to me, well, I think he was picked up a couple years later in Texas. I'm not finding it, but I don't want to be wrong, you know?
It took a few phone calls.
I don't have a number. I just have a name. I just want to make sure I'm not missing something. If I give you the name, can you double check that there's nothing in there? I don't see anything.
No one found anything. As far as I can tell, this arrest never happened. Now, on to the wallet. This is harder to substantiate. Dr. Garrett Boone was the longtime coroner in Butler County. He didn't conduct Beth's autopsy. That was done by Deputy Coroner James Swinehart, but Boone oversaw the procedure and ran the office. The story was that when Boone died, Beth's wallet was found in his safe. I called the coroner's office. No dice. I asked Beth's family if the wallet had been returned to them after Boone died. They said no. I checked newspaper clips to see if anyone had reported the discovery of this wallet, but there were none. What I did find was a letter dated February 4th, 1980. Boone had retired in 79, so the letter was from his successor, Dr. Richard Burkhart. The letter read, quote, Dear Mr. Andes, in reply to your inquiry about a wallet that belonged to your daughter Elizabeth, the coroner's report states, no property retained by the coroner's office. And looking through our unclaimed property, we did not find a wallet of this description. Dr. Boone's secretary does not remember any property of Elizabeth's being brought into the office. Mrs. Boone has no knowledge of this property. End quote. So until someone shows me proof, I have to put this one in the not substantiated column. As I was writing this tie up the loose ends episode, a sort of theme kept popping into mind. Evolution. It feels like everyone's evolved somehow in this case. Beth's family, Bob Young, Beth's friends. Everyone but, as far as I can tell, the original investigators. Some police practices have evolved since 1978. Things are studied and old ways of doing things have been tossed out in favor of new ways. In a few years, those will be set aside in favor of something else. It's one of my favorite parts of being alive. We can always evolve. To explain how Beth's family underwent their slow and inconsistent evolution, I'll share a story I learned that kind of put an exclamation point on it for me. 5 months after Bob was acquitted, he attended the wedding of Hallie Chapman and Rich McCauley. They hadn't set a date before Beth was killed, but losing her kind of kicked them into gear. And Beth has stayed part of their lives, even playing into their daughter's name and more recently their granddaughter's name as well.
Not that we wouldn't have ended up together anyway, right? We had known each other since we were very young. But one thing that has brought both of us, you know, a lot of comfort in managing this is that he knew Beth well. So for me, that chapter in my life is still alive because he can live those memories with me. He can support naming Emily, Emily Beth, and then Emily naming her daughter, Chloe Beth. You know, we can all sort of live this life together, knowing that there's someone who really gets it.
But Hallie and Rich's wedding also highlights just how far the Andes family has come and how they view Bob Young. See, Beth's brother and two sisters were invited to the wedding, and so was Bob. This was a little awkward because as much as Hallie loved and missed and wanted to support her slain friend's family, she had been called as a character witness for Bob. The murder and the charges had driven a wedge between the family and a lot of Beth's friends because they were on opposite sides of the courtroom. It wasn't that the Andes family never had doubts early on, according to Deb Lyden.
And I know the family, the parents in particular, the dad of Beth Andes, kept asking the prosecutor's office, are you sure he could have done this in the amount of time he had getting from Fairborn, Ohio, where he had to drive over an hour and 20 minutes, may have taken an hour and 30 minutes. How could he have done this in the time? You know, it just really seems odd. And they said, oh, no, he did it. He did it. He did it.
The family didn't really have much choice but to believe. Can you imagine if they'd pushed back before the trial? It would have looked like they didn't want Beth's murder solved. And besides, they didn't know Bob all that well. Not well enough to be absolutely certain he didn't have a dark side they hadn't seen. On the family side, Chuck had spent the most time with Bob because he had come up to Miami for a few siblings' days during Beth's time at college. He remembers they hung out together, went to a concert. Bob seemed like a nice, laid-back guy, so he was the most torn in the family about whether the charges had merit. That's why he accepted the wedding invitation after the trial. As Hallie and Rich recall, they didn't really notice that whichever of their parents did the seating arrangements grouped the Miami crew at the same table. So Chuck was seated just a few feet away from the man who had been acquitted of killing his sister just months before. Hallie cringes about it in hindsight.
I talked to Chuck a little bit about this morning. You know, it was a pit. Chuck was very young when this happened.
It was high school, wasn't it?
Very young.
Yeah, I think 16, 17.
And so he chose to come to our wedding. He wanted to come to our wedding. Our putting him at the same table as Bob, I have no idea what we were thinking. In fact, Rich, I'm guessing that as table assignments were made by our parents, that that was probably something that we didn't realize.
I think that was our way of saying, hey, Bob didn't do this. This is what we remember of Miami. This was all...
It was the whole Miami table, right?
Yeah. There wasn't even any of our Cleveland friends. It was the Miami table.
It was the Miami table, and the picture very clearly shows it was that crew.
And it was like, of course Chuck should be there. That this feels okay because this is the Miami table. Beth was part of the Miami group, and you're representing Beth.
The wedding photographer swung by the tables for the grip and grins, you know, the cheesy posed table portraits to document who showed up, because a happy couple is surely too harried to remember. The photo of the Miami table is undeniably awkward. Everyone is smiling except for Beth's brother, who looks like he's really struggling. Bob's smiling, but it doesn't look genuine. Bob remembers talking to Chuck after the wedding. He's pretty sure he even gave him a car ride to a hotel or a friend's house or something.
And he seemed to be okay.
Did you talk about Beth?
A little bit, but not much, you know, but some. I don't really know You know, more like along the lines, you know, I miss her. You know, look, what did she want to have about getting married, have kids? I talked to her a little bit. I remember something along those lines. I saw she wanted to have, I think it was 3 or 4 kids. And so we did talk a little bit about it.
Bob didn't know it at the time, but he was talking to the only member of the Andes family who was then willing to consider that he might be innocent. The next year, on the day after Christmas in 1980, Bob was blindsided by the civil wrongful death suit filed by Beth's father. Miami Student newspaper wrote about the filing. In it, Bob's quoted as saying, quote, "I thought it was all over. I'm still trying to get my life back together. I'm actually being tried again for the same damn thing," end quote. He was crushed the family still thought he was responsible and gave up hope they might someday think otherwise.
Did you ever talk to them?
No.
After? Never a word?
No, they sent stuff back to me. You know, some, I don't know, letters. I think that ring that I'd given her sent it back to me, and no, never had any conversation.
To say that losing Beth devastated the family is just silly. I can't put into words what this loss has done to them, the ripple effects it's had on their relationships and how they've raised their children. I feel like it'd be insulting to even try. Surely, Beth's mother had been so close to her middle daughter that Beth's friends thought of her as another girlfriend. Beth didn't call her mom. She called her Shirley because they were equals. Shirley died in 2014. She's buried next to Beth in Rocky River. Beth's father fought to figure out what happened to Beth. As Rich McCauley told us after the criminal trial,
I vividly remember Mr. Andy standing up and saying, "Then who killed my daughter?"
Charles Andes recruited a new lawyer to look at the evidence, and that attorney, Morris Levin from Case Western Reserve University, agreed with police. Bob Young must have done it. The lawsuit they filed sought $3 million in damages. A few years after the family lost that suit, as their father slid into ill health, Beth's older sister, Leslie, became the vocal one. She worked in law enforcement as a reserve officer for a while. She tells me that after Bob's acquittal, her parents were lost. They felt drained and defeated. A little time passed and they said, "We need to keep looking." But Leslie says Oxford police told them they'd done everything they could. Leslie began pushing harder in the 1990s. She shared with me emails between her and former Chief Schwein, who replied that the seal Bob got to clear his arrest record meant the case couldn't be reopened at all. There would be brief moments of resuscitation with an officer being assigned to look into things, but then Leslie would call back to check on the progress, and she says there'd always be some excuse for inaction. The assigned officer had surgery, he was working on another project, whatever. The emails continued sporadically for years until one day, Schwein abruptly wrote that he was retiring, and it would be up to his successor what to do next. Leslie began to feel as defeated as her parents had. She spoke to me on the record, but asked that I not use her voice. She told me, quote, "I feel like we've been jerked around since day one," end quote. By the time I talked to Leslie, she no longer thought Bob was guilty. I asked her how the change of heart came about. She said, quote, "It wasn't any one thing. It became clear over many years that they were so determined to say they were right and Bob was the murderer, that there was no need to further investigate, despite the fact that so many things didn't make sense and evidence was missing. Finally, I thought, are they just trying to hide the fact that they're not right? The delays in obfuscating and people saying they were going to help but never did. What are they hiding here? Why is nobody interested in this?" End quote. For his part, Schwein says he was interested, but that his hands were tied because Michael Moser and the lawyer representing that office said he couldn't look at the case file.
To find out that I couldn't even put my hands on anything, was just really a deflator for my hopes. You know, I just kind of hit rock bottom.
He says it wasn't that he didn't care. It's that he felt helpless.
You know, that's about the time that I was talking to Beth's sister. And if you don't have empathy for the family of people, if you've never talked to these people, you don't know them, you know, you don't know their heartache. At that time, she was worried about the health of her father, I think it was, mostly. And She wanted her father to know the truth. Sometimes the truth's more important than justice, you know? And to me, if we can get at the truth in this case, and I say we, you know, I have a vested interest in it. I really would like to see this case come to a conclusion, a positive conclusion. This is who killed Beth Andes.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
While the family's view of Bob Young evolved over time, the original investigators seemed fixed. Leslie Andes, Beth's older sister, says that in 1992 or 93, she met with Detective Baird to talk about how the investigation had been handled and whether anyone else should be pursued. Leslie told me, quote, "He spent the whole time convincing me, yeah, we got the right guy, we've done all we can," end quote. In hindsight, she calls it smoke and mirrors, a little pat on the head to assure they'd done their job and it was time for the family to accept that they lost. Amanda and I decided early on that we would, of course, weigh Bob Young as a suspect, but that we wouldn't accept the police theory it was him unless the evidence backed it up. And let's just say we've been very fluid in our thinking throughout this project. Sometimes we're set on a theory, and then we learn something new, and that theory's tossed out the window. It's tiring, for sure, but I consider an open mind a good thing. When we sat down with Bob, we pressed him on the confession. We can talk to all kinds of experts about the fact that false confessions happen, but we needed to hear why from him.
Thank God what I was saying didn't happen, or I would have been in real trouble, because what, you know, the stuff I confessed to, that's not what it really happened. And so that's really probably the only thing that kept me out of going to jail, is what I signed didn't really make sense of what actually happened. So, but that was just, you know, I was doing that based on, you know, that first turn on the light and see.
So did your parents, did they, you know, why the hell would you, I mean, how many people did you have to explain this to in terms of, because everybody's like, oh, there's no way you could put a gun to my head and I wouldn't admit to something I didn't do.
Yeah, I've explained that a lot over the years. And, you know, when I sit here, it's like, I don't know why I did it either. But, you know, at the time, even the next day, it was when I got out and even, you know, was in the jail cell, I was like, well, why did you do that? But after going through that interrogation, now I would have probably... I see why I did it, but it's hard to explain that to anybody else, because most people were like you just said, they're not going to admit to something they didn't do. And the only thing I can say is shock, and who's ever walked in and saw something like that? I mean, how do you know what you're really going to react? You know, I didn't expect to ever see anything like that in my lifetime, and I don't know how anybody else would react. That's how I reacted.
Your parents never wavered, though. They asked you the one time. Are they still around?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. They kind of deserve a medal, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So you went home with them. How does this unfold? Do you need a minute? Do you want a minute?
I'm good.
Somehow, without ever looking Bob in the eye and hearing him explain this, the Andes family has let their thinking evolve over the years. They say now that their first theory was flawed. They're still confused and hurt by Bob Young's confession, but they don't blame him anymore. They blame police and prosecutors. Here's their lawyer.
I mean, obviously they're most distressed over the loss of their sister. And this was incredibly hard on their parents. The mom is gone now. She passed away within the last year or two. The dad is in a nursing home. I think they really, really wanted to have closure before their parents passed away. They would really love to have closure before their dad passes away. And I think they would like the public to know how the case was mishandled.
Lydon wonders if maybe the Butler County Prosecutor's Office was determined to keep this case in the solved column because they hadn't been able to close those other murders I described in the serial killer episode. Victoria Hincher and Nancy Ann Theobald from 76 and 77.
They had happened in the same time of year. And therefore, it looked as if this very well could have been a serial killer who was involved in all three of them. So, you know, which made me wonder whether Butler County Prosecutor's Office was so intent on finding someone because they had not been able to find anyone who had killed the girls in 1976 and 1977. And so with Bob Young, with a confession being forced out of him and then saying he's the one who killed Beth, it was like, we don't have to work on that one anymore. We've at least solved one crime.
We invited Prosecutor Moser to respond to this, but he's still not taking our calls. Or Deb Lydon's, even.
Have you ever talked to Mr. Moser yourself?
No, I've talked to his assistant prosecutor, Mr. Gates.
That's Roger Gates, chief attorney in the civil division.
And has he been helpful?
No. Not at all.
In what kinds of ways?
As I understand it, my partner, Joanne Schreiner, talked to him first. He was incredibly rude to her, as I understand it. Was not interested in being helpful. When I got involved and went to court a few times, he kept trying to tell the Oxford police attorney, you know, don't let her get anything. You know, tell her it's an open case. Tell her you can't give her any. He's saying this in front of me, telling them to fight it. And yet, nobody was investigating the case. So it's just on the times when I interacted with him, whether it be on the phone or at court or whatever, he was not helpful and seemed as if he did not want us looking at the file.
So you heard him say that yourself?
Yes.
I tried to go through a subordinate when I first had trouble reaching Michael Moser. Steve McHugh, the lawyer of the Oxford Police Department, spoke to me early in my reporting. He's the one who said the evidence had maybe been given back to Beth's family. But he wouldn't comment on much.
Okay. Do you know why the case isn't listed on Ohio's cold case list?
No, I can't say. I don't know.
I mean, should it be?
That's really not my call. I'm not going to really comment one way or another.
He said he'd call me back with some answers, but he never did, and he hasn't returned my subsequent calls. It became clear I'd have to be persistent with Moser, so I've been paying attention to news related to his office. He has made headlines in recent months because he's being sued by a sheriff's deputy over comments he wrote last year in a letter to Sheriff Richard Jones. Moser had called Deputy Jason Hatfield a, quote, rogue deputy, and suggested a criminal investigation into Hatfield's behavior. It's an odd conflict. Moser doesn't oversee county deputies. The sheriff does. The suit might highlight a bit of a power struggle there. In early August, after repeated attempts to reach Moser through his assistants, I learned about a press conference being held in the building that houses his office, so Amanda and I attended. Sure enough, Moser was there. He didn't speak at the event and left immediately after the conference ended, so I approached him in the building lobby as he was headed toward the elevators. Here's our exchange.
Excuse me, Mr. Moser. Hi. I'm Amber Hunt with the Enquirer. I've been trying to set up a meeting with you for some time. Yeah.
Really?
Could we do that?
No.
Why is that?
Because I'm very busy. Goodbye.
Okay. Do you happen to know where the evidence is in the Elizabeth Andes case? You're getting off the elevator now?
No, I was just looking for somebody. But I might be getting off the elevator.
Would you like to tell me why you won't talk to me about this particular case?
Maybe someday. Maybe someday.
Well,
not
it would
today.
Be helpful.
But not today.
Well, could I schedule a time?
No.
Okay. So if I can't schedule a time and you're telling me that you won't talk to me now, then are you saying no comment? So that's usually what I hear from people who don't want to speak to me. Are you saying no comment?
Goodbye.
There's been enormous evolution, not just in the Andes family, but in the world of crime solving since 1978. Even the way in which suspects are interrogated has shifted, largely because the old way seemed to spark a lot of false confessions. There's a newer technique being touted called high-value detainee interrogation group. It's called HIG for short. The old technique was guilt presumptive. Interrogators would walk in with their gut suspicions and basically bluff. We know you did this, so you'd better tell us everything if you want to see daylight again. The HIG technique goes about it entirely differently. Instead of coming in ready for confrontation, the interrogator walks in ready to listen. She's probably bringing the suspect a Coke and a sandwich, and everything is much more conversational. Now, her gut might still be certain that she's talking to a guilty person, but her demeanor doesn't show it. The goal is to keep the subject talking, because if he talks long enough, he might say so much that he ends up contradicting verifiable information. The devil's in the details, right? I talked about the HIG technique with investigative journalist Robert Kolker, who wrote an article last month about it for Wired magazine.
So, you know, ever since they started using DNA to exonerate people, they recognized that an alarming number of the false convictions were based on cases in which people confessed. And so there was data, you know, hard data to suggest that something was the matter. And for decades, law professors and criminologists were claiming it was the interrogation methods that were creating tunnel vision, but the police response was always, how could you possibly know that, and why would anyone confess to a crime they didn't commit? And so there was a stalemate. But what's happened recently is a couple things. The first is that other societies like England have moved beyond the stalemate and revised their interrogation techniques into something more open-ended and less prosecutorial.
Because the thinking is more, we listen to you and we're kind of looking for discrepancies rather than coming in and like, I know your fingerprints are going to be on that knife.
Exactly. It basically disproves the whole theory that if you walk in with a theme or a theory of the case and you try and push it, that the person will either push back or not, and then you'll get the truth. That's been shown not to be effective. And it's also been shown in some cases to lead to false confessions. So instead, you go in and say, talk to me. You do less talking and they do more talking.
You know that scene in pretty much every police show where a chiseled detective barks, just give me 10 minutes in a room and I'll get that guy to crack? That's the antithesis of the HIG technique. Kolker says it's meant to end the game of cat and mouse you see in the TV shows. To be clear, not everyone's immediately embracing this new thinking.
We're very early in the story on the new technique, in America at least. The HIG has convinced the LAPD to use it on a pilot basis, but that's not department-wide there. They are also doing some work with Dallas and with Philadelphia, but I'm not sure they've actually trained any detectives, and I don't know if they're working in live cases with it at the moment. It's really just the beginning. And one expects there would be pushback if you tell people who've been doing their job the same way for 30 years that they've been doing it wrong.
That there even is a new technique underscores to me that police procedures are constantly evolving. So why can't Butler officials just consider that their way of investigating 37 years ago maybe didn't produce perfect results? Is it not worth considering?
With everyone fighting for attention,
How can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media posting, and even events management. Don't know much about marketing? No sweat. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Tackle any challenge with Constant Contact's expert live customer support. Plus, everything's backed by their 30-day money-back guarantee. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
Lieutenant Jeff Robinson of the Oxford Police Department is weighing other possibilities. But if he builds a case against anyone, the normal procedure in Butler County would be to bring that case to Michael Moser to decide whether to prosecute. In this case, Robinson might have to consider requesting a special prosecutor given Moser's history with the case. Bob Young has evolved in some ways, but in others, he's kind of stuck. He never really got to grieve his girlfriend's murder. He had the case sealed because he felt like he was being harassed. But attorney Deb Lyden says that when she asked him to loosen the restrictions on the seal, he sounded ready to move forward.
And the first thing he said to me when I called him and I explained to him that I was working with Andy's family and that I knew it would be hard for him to speak with me, the first response he gave to me was, "I don't mind talking to you. I think about her every day."
In 1984, 6 years after Beth was killed, Bob reconnected with a woman from his hometown at their 10-year high school reunion. 2 years later, they got married, and a few years after that, they had a daughter named Paige.
I was pretty overprotective of Paige and, you know, growing up, and I guess until she got her car, and then she started going out. But still, I worried all the time, you know, who she's going out with, who's, you know, all that stuff. So yeah, it definitely had an impact on probably how I raised her and just about making sure she was aware of her surroundings and, you know, pay attention and don't lose control, be in control of yourself all the time just so nothing happens to you, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's overprotection stuff. I was probably leading the way on that. She'll probably admit to that.
Bob didn't tell his daughter about Beth until shortly before our interview. She said, "Yeah, I know." It turned out that her mother, now Bob's ex-wife, had filled her in when she was younger, possibly in an effort to explain why Dad seemed so paranoid. That's not the only lasting effect losing Beth had on Bob.
Do you think you would have married her?
Probably so, yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Or three or four kids in your cars?
Well, you know, I came from three. I would say three. I don't know about four, but three probably would have been good. So, yeah, who knows?
I mean, you kind of have to you're dealing with two separate traumas, really. I mean, losing a girlfriend is awful. And then separate from that, being accused of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... like I said, it has impacted my life, but you know, I don't talk about it much. I just kind of, I guess, compartmentalize it, is what they say, and just go forward. It's all I've done for 35 years, so.
So what now? Our hope hasn't changed since episode one. We still want this solved. Through the course of this reporting, Lieutenant Robinson has been kind of hit and miss in responding to us, but we've done our best to help him. We were the first people in decades to find and talk to Steve Green and Buzz Call and John Shea and Al Gerard, among dozens of others. So when someone has said something interesting, we've passed it along. Robinson and Jen Lebo, the forensic interrogator I mentioned a few episodes back, have been knocking on doors and making phone calls in ways that haven't been done by law enforcement on this case since the week Beth died. Robinson set up tip lines via phone and email that we've had displayed on our website. If you haven't seen them there but have information to share, the number is 513-524-5268, and the email is crimetips@cityofoxford.org. Because I'm a reporter, I likely won't hear a whole lot about new developments in the case until Robinson decides they're pretty solid and okay to release. I admit it's a strange feeling to have to let go of something you've invested your heart and soul into, but it's what has to happen for the case to move forward. I do know that they've been meeting with outside experts, people with specialized expertise to spot clues that the 78 investigators may be missed. For example, I mentioned before that Beth's body was bruised. There's actually a pretty odd pattern of bruising on her stomach that no one has been able to identify. Deb Lyden thinks it's a boot print. Robinson thought maybe it was a handprint, but I don't see it as either. To me, it looks like some kind of tool with spokes or fingers on it, but what do I know? Lebo says it's time we nail it down, so she's been sharing photos with more experts. I hope someday I can report something definitive on that. The case also might be weighed by a cold case organization that former FBI agent Dan Vogel belongs to. The American Investigative Society of Cold Cases sounds a bit like VDOC, which already heard the case, but there's a difference. VDOC meets over a luncheon and discusses possibilities based on a presentation by a police department. The AISCC is more hands-on. They might use crime scene reconstruction or even re-interview witnesses. We'll see what happens. Former Chief Schwein thinks new eyes would be a smart move. He always believed his detectives when they told him about the football player who got away with murder. Now he's not so sure.
After I've had time to think about it, and in light of the fact that he's waived his privilege to keep that file closed, he says, go ahead and open it up, look at it. I'm thinking, you know, looking back at the timeline, are we crazy enough to believe maybe that there wasn't another Ted Bundy going around and work in the north while he was working his way east and south, you know? Who knows? That person could still be out there, could still be alive, you know?
Sometimes I'm bold enough to allow myself to daydream about a conviction, a real one, based on real evidence. But as anyone in law enforcement would tell you, every week that's passed has made that less and less likely. The odds are pretty astronomical now, as profiler Richard Walter was quick to tell me.
There are about 191,000 documented cold cases in the United States as we speak right now. Do you think all those parents and all those are going to get fair justice? Hell no.
He's right. There are a lot of unsolved cases out there. This is real life, not a TV show. Things don't always get a happy ending, or any ending at all. But does that mean we should quit trying? Hallie says the case has changed how she views some police agencies.
You know, the real tragedy in all of this is there was a killer on the loose. There was, we were, as co-eds, in danger. And while the Oxford police were very intent on telling the story and positioning the case as a domestic situation, the nagging feeling that I had as someone, and Rich, knowing that this was not Bob, was, who was it? And being very clear with the police around whom I felt could have been investigated.
Bob Young says no matter how much time has passed, it still matters. As long as there are leads to follow, he sees no reason for the case to go dormant again. And the work Amanda and I have done has him convinced the leads haven't dried up yet.
I guess you want it to go on so they find an answer. They find, I know the Andy's family wants closure on it. I would like closure on it. I don't like the fact that, you know, I don't even know this, but how many people in my hometown think maybe I'm guilty, I had a good lawyer, I got off. I don't know, but I would like closure on it too, just so, you know, I know it's not about me, but it would be nice to have closure for her family, for me, you know, my friends. It would be good. I would like to see it.
So would we. This marks the end of the podcast. But rest assured, we'll keep collecting the puzzle pieces as long as we can find them. We never met Beth, but her story has shaped our year and really affected our lives. We won't give up on her. Thank you for listening to Accused, the unsolved murder of Elizabeth Andes. This is a special project from the Cincinnati Enquirer, narrated by Amber Hunt, produced by Amanda Rossman, edited by Amy Wilson, and engineered by Stephen Baum at Cincinnati Public Radio. Music was composed by Andrew Higley. To look at case documents, photos, videos, and more, visit cincinnati.com/accused podcast.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.